If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblogues.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Imagine this. You walk into your office on January 1st, and the entire budget for the year is, well, it's zero.
Literally zero. Not, you know, last year's budget minus a bit. We're talking a complete clean slate.
A total reset. And every single expense, I mean, everything from the paperclips in the drawer and heating the building, all the way up to your biggest strategic project.
Every line item. It has to be completely rejustified. From scratch.
And if you can't prove right now that it's absolutely indispensable for this year,
the funding's just gone. It vanishes. Oh. It sounds like a corporate nightmare, right? An annual inquisition for every single dollar.
It does. But that right there is the fundamental radical idea behind something called zero-based budgeting, or ZBB.
It's an attempt really to enforce a kind of pure, cold-blooded efficiency.
And that's exactly what we're going to dig into today. We've gone through the source material, and it lays out this really chaotic history of ZBB, its demanding mechanics, and how it's been applied, often brutally, in both the public and private sectors.
Right. And our goal here is for you, the listener, to get past that simple definition. We want to really understand the true cost, not just the financial cost, but the organizational cost of doing this.
Because it's so strange. On one hand, you have it being hailed as this cost-saving miracle.
Especially by corporate acquirers, yeah.
But on the other, it gets blamed for creating total bureaucratic paralysis and sometimes, you know, even for corporate failure years down the line.
So we're going to analyze the core of it, these things called decision packages, and trace the whole story from the U.S. federal government's big struggle with it under President Carter.
All the way to the Chinese government trying to adapt it, and then, of course, its ruthless use by firms like 3G Capital.
At its heart, the idea is that every expense has to be justified and approved in each new budget period.
Mm.
You start from that zero base, no funding just automatically rolls over from last year.
The intended goal, I guess, is to force managers to really assess if they're using resources efficiently. Can you provide this service at a lower cost, or should it even exist at all?
Exactly.
Mm.
But the sources are really clear on this from the get-go. There's a massive trade-off.
A huge one. That potential for savings comes at an enormous expense. The organizational effort involved is, well, it's like putting the entire company through a complete restructure.
Every single budget cycle.
Every year. And that's a level of pain that, frankly, very few organizations are willing to endure. Okay, so let's unpack the architecture of this pretty intense system. Where did it even come from?
Well, the history of ZBB doesn't start in Washington or on Wall Street, which is what you might expect.
Right.
It starts somewhere much more domestic. It starts with an accounting manager at Texas Instruments in Dallas. This is back in the early 1970s.
Okay.
A man named Peter Peer. And he's the original architect of the whole system.
And what was his motivation? Was he just trying to find a better way to cut costs?
That's the most important detail to understand about ZBB. Because, no, he wasn't just inventing a better knife for, you know, cutting the fat. His main goal was to improve strategic management. He wanted to bake strategic objectives right into the budgeting process.
How? By tying the cost justification to the actual functional areas that are supposed to be achieving those objectives.
Precisely. So he wasn't just asking that classic question, how much did you spend last year?
Right.
He was forcing managers to answer a totally different and much harder question. What are you trying to accomplish this year, and what's the absolute minimum you need to get it done?
That is fundamentally different from traditional budgeting.
Oh, completely. Traditional budgeting, it suffers from this thing accountants call incrementalism or momentum funding.
I think I know what you mean. If the IT department, say, spent $10 million last year,
they automatically expect $10 million plus, you know, a 3 or 4% bump for inflation next year.
Regardless of whether that $10 million was used well, or if half the projects are even still relevant.
Yes. That old system, it just inherently rewards managers who make sure to spend their entire budget by the end of the year.
Because they're afraid if they don't, they'll lose it next year. The classic use it or lose it.
Exactly. Peer's method just. It cuts that historical momentum completely. It forces management to allocate money based strictly on current needs and what they expect to achieve, not just on what they did last time.
That level of rigor, I mean, it must have been revolutionary in the early 70s.
It was. And that focus on radical transparency, on linking every dollar to a clear objective, meant it got noticed pretty quickly.
By anyone looking to reform a big, sprawling, inefficient bureaucracy, I'd imagine.
Whether corporate or public. Which brings us to its political debut, which was pretty surprising.
Where did it pop up?
Peter Peer was appointed by the governor of Georgia at the time, a guy named Jimmy Carter, to manage the state's entire budget.
Wow. Okay. So right into the public sector.
Right into the fire. This was a huge proving ground. It was for the state's 1973 fiscal budget. And it showed that ZBB wasn't just for, you know, a predictable manufacturing company.
It could, in theory, wrestle with the massive complexity of a state bureaucracy.
In theory, yes.
So let's get into the mechanics of it. Peer's system, it requires managers to create these super detailed documents for every activity. He called them decision packages.
Right, and these decision packages, they are the absolute heart of ZBB.
How so?
They're what transforms these big, vague spending categories into granular, action-oriented proposals. Each package for every activity has to answer four basic questions.
Okay, what are they?
One, what is the activity? Two, what is its purpose? Three, what are the quantifiable costs? And four, what are the measurable benefits? Or, and this is key, what happens if this activity isn't funded at all?
And you mentioned they're not static. It's not like you just asked for $500,000 for marketing. You have to propose different funding levels.
This is where the real work, and frankly, the pain of ZBB really comes into focus. For every single functional area, let's say customer service, the manager has to submit at least 3 or 4 distinct packages.
All ranked in order of priority.
All ranked.
Yeah.
So first you have what's called the base or minimum package.
It's the zero base we keep talking about.
It is. It outlines the absolute bare bones minimum funding you need to keep the program operational and, you know, legally compliant. As we'll get into later, defining that minimum is incredibly subjective, but it's the floor.
This is the, if we don't get at least this much, we might as well just shut the whole department down package.
Pretty much. Then second, you have the current package. This is the money you need to maintain the current level of service, but using the most efficient methods you can find.
So if you spent $1 million last year, maybe the current package is $950,000 this year. If you found some savings, but you're still achieving the same output.
Correct. And then you move into growth.
Okay.
The third type is the improvement or enhanced package. This describes, you know, additional incremental funding levels that would lead to real demonstrable improvements.
For instance, funding package 3 might let the customer service team cut wait times by 20% because they can buy new software.
Exactly. And the fourth, which is sometimes separate, is the true zero package, the consequences of total elimination. What happens if this function just ceases to exist tomorrow?
Wow. And once all these packages are created, they're not just looked at in a silo, right? They're ranked against every other department.
That's the key. They're ranked against packages from everywhere in the organization. The customer service enhanced package might end up ranked lower than the R&D team's minimum package.
And that forces a trade-off.
It does. Funds are then allocated down that master rank list until the total budget is gone.
So whatever falls below that cutoff line,
right,
it just doesn't get funded for the year.
It's dead for the year. That level of cross-functional ranking, it sounds incredibly complex, but it is also incredibly powerful for forcing an organization to admit what its real priorities are.
No more hiding. If you run out of money after package 200, then package 201, no matter how passionately its manager defends it, is gone.
The logic is compelling. You start from a clean slate to see if things can be done cheaper. But the operational lift, it is immense,
yeah,
which is why we have to talk about that great trade-off.
All right, let's start this section by putting ourselves in the shoes of a CFO. You're using traditional budgeting. You're sick of the waste. Why is ZBB so appealing? The sales pitch has to be pretty potent.
It's incredibly potent. The main advantage is it's its surgical ability to just sever organizational inertia.
Breaking that historical spending momentum you mentioned.
Exactly. If you've got a department running some outdated piece of software that costs $1 million a year, and nobody even remembers why they bought it, ZBB forces that cost out into the open for a full justification.
So it has this huge potential for rooting out that kind of systemic, long-term, redundant spending.
It does. And it changes the whole behavioral dynamic for managers, doesn't it?
It seems like it would. Under the old system, you're incentivized to spend everything or you lose it.
Right. But under ZBB, you're incentivized to propose the leanest, most efficient structure possible for your department.
Because you know you're competing for scarce resources with every other manager in the company.
Precisely. And our sources point out something interesting. ZBB can actually improve internal communication.
How so?
Because every single expense is up for review. Employees from all over the company have to get involved in the decision-making. When you have to defend your entire function from a zero base, you need input from everyone who relies on you to build the strongest case.
That's a side of it that's often overlooked. It pulls the budgeting process out of the back rooms at the accounting department and puts it right on the operational floor.
And this is crucial for big companies. ZBB doesn't have to be this yearly organizational trauma for everyone at once.
You can stagger it.
Right. You can use it as a rolling process. Spread the pain over, say, a 3-year cycle.
So maybe this year, only R&D and marketing have to go through the full ZBB review, and next year, it's finance and operations.
Exactly. That makes the whole concept a lot more palatable for these massive global companies.
Okay, so those are the upsides. Surgical cost control, strategic alignment, breaking inertia. But now we have to talk about the price. The significant operational costs that make a full, pure ZBB implementation? Well, doubtful in almost any large organization.
This is where the organization really starts to pay for all that efficiency.
With what? Administrative paralysis.
That's the good way to put it. The most immediate downside is the just sheer time and resource drain.
Mm.
Developing and ranking hundreds, maybe thousands, of these granular decision packages takes a ton of time, a ton of effort.
And you often need more staff just to manage the paperwork and the data analysis.
It's essentially a complete formal restructuring of the organization every single time you run the process.
That sounds absolutely exhausting. I mean, think about the average manager. They're already supposed to be managing people, output, strategy.
And now they have to dedicate weeks, maybe months, just compiling data to defend their own existence.
And because the stakes are so high, the survival of your project, maybe even your team, is on the line, it invites the worst possible outcome.
Political gaming.
Yeah. You run this massive risk of managers just dedicating all their effort to crafting these perfect justifications for what are fundamentally their pet projects.
They frame them as absolutely necessary to ensure their own survival or, you know, their department's power.
So ZBB, which is supposed to remove subjectivity, actually ends up rewarding the most politically savvy managers, the best writers and presenters.
And not necessarily the most essential functions.
That's a huge consequence.
It is. And the difficulty of justifying things is made even worse by external uncertainty. How can a department justify a rigid budget a year out when they don't know what the market is going to do?
Or if their supply chain is going to be disrupted, it forces them to make these hard-ranked choices today based on performance metrics that might be totally irrelevant in 6 months.
Right. And finally, there's the managerial rigidity problem. All that time managers spend on these decision packages, it comes at the expense of their other duties.
Like actual strategic planning or, I don't know, innovation, yeah. Responding to the market.
And that focus creates a dangerous lack of flexibility. When your managers are locked into this high-effort budget defense, they can't react quickly to sudden changes.
Like a surprise competitor or a departmental emergency that needs immediate, unexpected funding.
The money might be delayed because the managerial staff is just buried in the ZBB process. Your operational agility, your speed of decision-making, it just takes a catastrophic hit.
So it's a fantastic system for trimming structural fat, but an absolute nightmare for responding to a crisis or seizing an opportunity.
Seems so. The unique value which both Pyre and later firms like 3G really capitalized on is that mandatory strategic alignment. An audit looks backwards. It flags misuse of funds.
But ZBB forces you to look forward.
And ask, if we were rebuilding this company from scratch today, would we even fund this activity?
Mm-hmm.
It's the sheer force of that question that makes ZBB so attractive, despite all the pain. It's a tool for institutional introspection, not just for flagging expenses.
And this tension, this conflict between efficiency and flexibility, that's exactly why ZBB had such a complicated and ultimately a very brief run in the U.S. government.
The public sector's attempt at ZBB is this crucial case study. It really shows how a rigorous technical concept can just collapse under the weight of bureaucracy and political reality.
So after Jimmy Carter was elected president, the federal government officially implemented it in the late 1970s.
Yeah, through the Government Economy and Spending Reform Act of 1976.
And the stated goal, according to the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, was to optimize the outputs you could get at different budget levels.
Right. The requirement was incredibly strict. Agencies had to set priorities based on what they could achieve at alternative spending levels. And crucially, one of those levels had to be below what they were currently getting.
No more automatic rollovers.
None. But here's where it immediately got complicated. ZBB had three main user groups in the federal government, and they all wanted different things from it.
Okay, so you had Congress, the legislative branch. They needed these broad summaries about public priorities, how changes would impact their constituents.
Then you had the agency level itself, the department managers. They needed super detailed information on implementation, workload, you know, operational efficiencies.
And finally, the executive branch, the president and the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, they were trying to synthesize it all and focus on major policy issues.
Right. And even though they had different focuses, they all had to answer that one fundamental question. Are our current activities effective, and should they be reduced or just eliminated?
But that simple question led to this massive confusion over what zero base actually meant in practice.
This is the central misunderstanding. The headline definition is simple: starting budgets from scratch.
Reviewing every invoice.
Exactly. But Peter Sorrent, who is the director of management and—
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions: hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Alice's training during the Carter implementation, he noted that ZBB just meant different things to different people.
Because it's a practical impossibility, right? In a huge agency like the Department of Defense.
Or Health and Human Services.
A complete, literal, zero-based review of every single program in one budget cycle. It's not feasible. You'd create a paralyzing amount of paperwork.
And managers would spend all their time writing justifications instead of actually running their programs. So if you try to implement ZBB in its purest sense, you basically break the government with bureaucracy.
So what did they do instead? What did it default to?
It ended up resembling something else entirely, a sunset review process.
Which is a crucial distinction. A sunset review is where a program is given a fixed lifespan, say 5 years.
And when that sunsets, the program is just eliminated unless there's overwhelming proof that it's still effective and necessary.
It achieves a similar goal-forcing justification, but it's structurally very different from ZBB's ranking of alternative funding levels.
It is, and the sources are very clear. There is no evidence that the federal ZBB implementation ever actually included building budgets from the bottom up or reviewing every invoice. It was functionally impossible.
So, if it wasn't a total clean slate, what did zero base actually mean in the public sector context back then?
Well, we can go back to Sarant's definition, which came out of that training experience.
Yeah.
They tried to create a measurable standard.
And what was it?
They defined the zero base as the minimum level of funding necessary to keep a program alive.
The level below which it's just not feasible to continue because it can't make any constructive contribution toward its objective.
Right. But look at the subjectivity in that definition. It's huge.
Immense. How do you objectively define the minimum level for, say, a national park program? It just invites political exaggeration. Managers will inflate their minimum to protect their turf.
And if the minimum level is defined by the person trying to protect their budget, the whole premise of the zero base is undermined.
It collapses.
It does. And the states, who had tried ZBB before the feds, they saw this flaw immediately.
So how did they deal with the subjectivity?
They chose arbitrary percentages. They basically took the manager's subjectivity out of the equation.
So instead of asking the manager, what's your minimum viable funding, the state would just impose a cut.
Exactly. They would stipulate that one alternative request must be, say, 80% of last year's funding, whether the manager thought that was feasible or not.
And that turns the process into a measurable analysis of impact. It forces the management to detail the real-world consequences of a 20% funding cut.
That arbitrary number became the standardized operational definition of the zero-base level. It made the ranking process tangible, even if it wasn't as philosophically pure as Pyre wanted.
But no matter how they define that zero level, the whole structure, the decision packages, the ranking, it all hinges on one critical thing.
Quality performance measures.
You can't rank programs against each other without objective data.
Performance measures are the oxygen ZBB breathes. You need robust measures of effectiveness, efficiency, workload, everything. If you don't know exactly what you're achieving with your money, how many citizens served, how many widgets produced per dollar, you can't rationally rank your decision package against someone else's.
And the sources show this was the breaking point for the federal implementation. The GAO noted that agencies complain they just didn't have enough time to implement it.
Specifically because they lacked the historical data and the analytical capacity to even develop those performance measures under deadline.
So program managers, they were just struggling to identify alternatives or create rational packages because they didn't have the internal metrics to back them up.
They were excellent at their jobs, but not at measuring their own efficiency in this quantifiable, universally comparable way.
Yeah.
And without those measures, the whole ranking process just, it falls apart. It goes back to being a subjective political decision.
And that operational difficulty, the paperwork, the lack of data, the timelines, it all led to ZBB's official elimination from federal budgeting.
August 7th, 1981. It was gone less than 5 years after it started.
But that's not the end of the story, is it? The sources say it left this enduring legacy.
A critical one. ZBB established, deep within federal budgeting, the requirement to present alternative levels of funding and, crucially, to link those levels to alternative results.
So that structural element, the idea of analyzing multiple funding scenarios instead of just one big request, that was incredibly sticky.
It remained in effect through the Reagan, Bush, and early Clinton administrations all the way until 1994. It shows ZBB's lasting but modified influence long after the name itself was scrapped. It forced a new kind of transparency.
And this enduring influence showed up in a couple of practical reforms, right? They salvaged the useful parts of ZBB.
Two notable ones were widely adopted. The first was in how budget requests were structured.
Moving away from the complex decision packages, but keeping the idea of scenarios.
Right. Departments would submit requests with three main tiers: a specified cut percentage, the reduction scenario, the current spending level, and an increased percentage.
And that tiered approach, it allowed for trading priorities between departments at a high level.
A department getting a cut might be okay with it if they could see the money was explicitly going to another department's higher priority project. It created a dynamic for resource reallocation that just didn't exist before.
And the second big reform was the widespread adoption of sunset legislation, which we touched on earlier.
Putting programs under periodic legislated review to determine their efficiency and necessity, it became a standard way to get the accountability ZBB was after.
But without the massive annual administrative burden of the full process.
ZBB was just too radical for ongoing government life. But its core principles, they transformed public finance forever.
So the challenges the U.S. government faced with paperwork and complexity, they must have been magnified when ZBB was exported to different bureaucratic and economic systems.
If anything, yes. Let's look at the Chinese adaptation, specifically in Hubei province, where the concept was introduced in the 1990s.
How did that go?
The initial attempt to use the traditional ZBB model failed almost immediately. The sources say the early years were incredibly rocky.
What happened?
Well, only a few departments even implemented the reform, which led to this chaotic situation where you had multiple departments using different incompatible budgeting systems. The results were poor, and you couldn't compare them.
So the traditional model, with its complexity and demand for detailed metrics, was just too cumbersome for the Chinese bureaucracy at that time.
They needed to streamline the administrative burden, and their solution was to create their own version, target-based budgeting, or TBB.
A Chinese-styled ZBB.
A radical modification of it, yeah. TBB required agencies to submit a much simpler, broad-stroke budget within a very rigid, preset time limit. It was a rapid, modified form of ZBB, focused more on hitting broad fiscal targets than on building granular decision packages.
Did it work?
It worked moderately well for the Hubei government. It helped them stabilize their spending over the years, but it suffered from some core compromises that really undermined the ZBB philosophy.
What were the lingering problems with this TBB system?
A few crucial ones. First, there was no truly unified budget across all government functions. And second, and this is more damaging to the ZBB concept, were the exemptions.
Exemptions.
Certain massive spending categories were, and still are, exempt from the zero-based review.
What kind of spending was shielded?
Things like essential operating expenses, most personnel costs, and critically, any government policies or programs that started after the budget year began.
Wait, so if your budget is supposed to be zero-based, but huge chunks of spending, like the entire government payroll, are automatically excluded?
Then the zero base is immediately compromised. The effectiveness of the whole ranking process is severely limited.
And just like in the U.S., politics got in the way.
Of course. High-level officials have their priority plans, and that influences where the finance department directs money, often just overriding the TBB's analytical findings.
So the central challenge remained unsolved: how to isolate objective, efficient spending from politically desirable spending.
Exactly. While China successfully adapted the concept to their structure by simplifying it, that core challenge remained.
But if the public sector struggled with ZBB's complexity, the private sector, well, they embraced its ruthlessness as a tool for immediate, dramatic profit.
This is where ZBB truly shocked the corporate world and led to massive profits, but also intense controversy.
We're talking about Carlos Brito and the investment firm 3G Capital.
Right, a protege of Jorge Paulo Lama. They institutionalized ZBB at Anheuser-Busch InBev way back in the 90s, and then they aggressively applied it to every single major acquisition they made.
3G Capital basically became synonymous with ZBB as this radical cost-cutting recipe.
And they used it relentlessly on brands you know. Burger King, Tim Hortons, Heinz, Kraft Foods, Popeyes.
If 3G acquired you, you knew your historical budget was dead on arrival.
Absolutely. The measures they took were often drastic, designed to strip out non-essential spending as quickly as possible. The sources detail the obvious things, like cutting hundreds of management jobs, getting rid of the corporate jets.
Eliminating entire layers of corporate staff.
But the philosophy of ZBB demands justification for every expense, even the small ones. And that led to some shockingly simple and often painful measures.
Hold on. You mentioned the simplicity of some of these cuts. Tell us again about the level of micromanagement ZBB required at these companies.
They eliminated things like company cars and free coffee. They made executives buy their own stationery. And the most famous example, requiring employees to physically get permission from a manager just to make photocopies.
That seems extreme. Isn't that costing more in managerial time than it saves in paper?
That's the paradox of it.
Mm-hmm.
It saves very little in paper, but it fundamentally changes the corporate culture.
It sends a signal.
A very loud signal from the top down that every single expense, no matter how small, is under scrutiny. This extreme cost control fueled the idea that ZBB is a fix-all for businesses trying to rapidly improve profitability after a big acquisition.
And by the financial metrics that shareholders care about, it often works, at least in the short term.
It absolutely works. Accenture provided specific examples. They cited a major consumer goods company that achieved 18% savings and saw a 20% jump in its share price using ZBB.
And a commercial bank that unlocked a huge amount of capital.
Capital that was previously just trapped in unnecessary operational spending. They successfully reinvested it into going digital.
So it's not just about cutting, it's about freeing up capital for strategic investment that would otherwise be impossible.
Precisely. We also saw a healthcare company achieve massive savings, 1.2 billion pounds, so about 1.36 billion euros, in just 3 years.
And companies like Unilever reported that ZBB was improving their marketing productivity, streamlining their ad spending.
So ZBB helps money flow to stockholders instead of into unused departments, overfunded programs, and just wasteful habits. And the most dramatic example of this short-term gain was the Kraft Heinz merger.
The financial results there were staggering.
3G's initial cost-cutting in Kraft, all done through ZBB, resulted in stock prices jumping 36%. This strategy of stripping away non-essential spending allowed the new company to compete very aggressively on price.
But this immediate success came with that intense controversy, the Kraft-Heinz contradiction.
Right. This highlights the central danger of ZBB when it's applied too rigorously or without a long-term strategic view.
While the immediate cuts made shareholders very happy, the later criticism was overwhelming.
Analysts, former employees, they directly blamed 3G's rigorous and potentially unsustainable use of ZBB for the company's poor performance and massive write-downs after that 2015 merger.
Why? What did the ZBB cuts destroy that led to that long-term failure?
They destroyed operational muscle, future capability. ZBB, when it's used as a blunt instrument, it often targets things like R&D, maintenance, brand building.
It's things that don't have an immediate provable return on investment.
Which makes them easy targets for elimination under a zero-based review. But when you cut R&D, you get product stagnation, you cut maintenance, you get operational breakdowns.
When you starve the core functions to please shareholders today, you compromise the company's ability to compete tomorrow.
It suggests there's this critical line where radical efficiency turns into operational starvation. You can only cut so much fat before you start cutting muscle and bone. ZBB is a brilliant financial tool, but it doesn't solve that very human challenge of knowing where the fat ends and where the muscle begins. Hashtag outro.
So after all that, what does this mean for organizations? We started with this radical promise of zero-based budgeting as the ultimate tool for efficiency.
But our deep dive confirms that the reality of implementing it is anything but simple or consistently successful.
The fundamental trade-off of ZBB seems crystal clear. On one side, you get radical efficiency, you break from historical momentum, and you get a sharp, immediate focus on shareholder value.
But you pay for it. You pay with extremely high administrative effort, potential managerial rigidity when you need to respond to change.
And that recurring subjective difficulty of even defining the zero base in a meaningful way without it just becoming a political game.
And that really is the key takeaway. ZBB, in its purest form, where every single line item is justified from scratch every single year, it's likely never been fully utilized anywhere, not in public or private sectors.
The complexity and the administrative paralysis that results, it's just too much. The human element can't sustain that level of scrutiny indefinitely.
Yet, its underlying principles have stuck around. That mandatory requirement to consider alternative funding levels and to formally link those scenarios to measurable performance.
That has fundamentally changed how many organizations, public and private, approach justification and how they allocate resources. It's a powerful system that survives, but only through constant necessary modification.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. ZBB is designed to strip away the historical momentum of spending, to force managers to be completely objective.
Given the immense effort required and the subjective nature of defining that minimum feasible level, a central paradox seems to emerge.
Doesn't its intense, almost adversarial focus on justification inadvertently reward the most politically savvy managers, the ones who can best package, market, and defend their pet projects to survive the ranking process?
Rather than simply rewarding the programs that are objectively the most essential for the organization's long-term health.
If ZBB requires perfect, unassailable performance metrics to work metrics of effectiveness, efficiency, and workload that are notoriously difficult to quantify and compare across diverse departments.
Is the problem really the budget method itself? Or is it the underlying inherent difficulty of truly measuring value in any complex human system? That's something to think about the next time you hear a CDO promise radical zero-based cost cuts.
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code PODCAST at joyandblokes.com.